Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, as part of our Let Motown Roll series, we're recasting Nate's 2022 discussion with Brooks Long about David Ritz's incredible biography of Marvin Gaye. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox. I'm joined once again by my colleague, Brooks Long, as we're discussing the oeuvre of David Ritz. Today, we're looking at two books by Ritz, mainly one, Divided Soul, The Life of Marvin Gaye, written entirely by Ritz, although Gaye was interviewed extensively for that one. And also, I use as a supplement for my research, After the Dance, My Life with Marvin Gaye by Jan Gaye, with David Ritz, Jan Gaye being Marvin's second wife. Brooks, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, glad to be back.
And this is a bit of a heavy topic. Marvin Gaye, One of the great American musicians, Rolling Stones, got What's Going On now anointed as the official number one best album of the baby boom era, or whatever they call their charts. He's been at pretty much a critical high since his death in the early 80s, and lots of issues in his personal life, to say the least.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, he's amazing. It seems like there was a little bit of time in between Brother Ray and Divided Soul for Ritz, but he couldn't have picked two more interesting people and more different people to dive into.
Absolutely. Ray Charles, we talked about last time you were on, and you know, Ray Charles comes across as this man of steel, basically. He's blind, yes. but he was a junkie, and he was a womanizer, but he got through all that and really rode it out into the sunset in fine form, you know, touring to the end of his days, having hits, not the kind of hits he had in his heyday, but was still active and successful all the way through, mastered this world. Marvin Gaye, for all his accomplishment, is not somebody you can say that about. Went into a vicious downward spiral that we'll talk about later in the late 70s, early 80s, ending in his murder by his father. And yeah, this book was very important for Ritz, I think. This was the first book that he authored solo. He was a ghostwriter for Ray Charles' autobiography. He worked closely with Marvin, multiple interviews, but they didn't work it out to publish an autobiography as such. And then there was some controversy because David Ritz is officially named as the co-author of Sexual Healing with Marvin, and I'm blanking on the co-composer. There's three credits on that one. And there's, you know, Ritz had to sue for that. And ultimately the case was thrown out, but he settled with the estate. He got his credit. He claims he has tape and notes that show he wrote the lyrics. So we're not in a position to dispute all that, but I do think we should note that, you know, the co-writer of the song and Freddie Cassart, who was Marvin's manager at the time, both dispute Ritz's account of events. But nonetheless, by all accounts, Ritz is credited with inspiring the name Sexual Healing. So at a minimum, and Odell Brown was the third author on that. Apologies. So at a minimum, he acted as a key source of inspiration. So you're not going to come across many situations where the author is a professional writer of Ritz's caliber and has this close a relationship, including a collaborative relationship with the author. So big doings here for David Ritz. Definitely. Thoughts on the Sexual Healing controversy?
Well, I think, two things. One is that it, I think among a lot of people, there was a lot of speculation about David Ritz and, you know, was he trying to get over and things like that. And it's come out in more recent years that he won his lawsuit because he had a tape of him and Marvin sketching it all out. And, you know, I can't even say if, you know, that is definitive, but it would make sense that, you know, that somebody who's interviewing for a book would have recordings of, you know, them talking together. So, you know, if that tape is real, then that's kind of the end of the case. But it, you know, there certainly is a certain amount of suspicion sometimes about David Ritz, although it must be said that he went on from this book to do lots of collaborations with lots of other R&B stars, including people who were incredibly good friends with Marvin Gaye. So,
absolutely. And I think that, you know, Odell could easily have co-written the music with Gaye, not been there when Ritz and Marvin worked on the lyrics and not really known what he was talking about, and just been honest saying, hey, I didn't see the guy working on the song, but that's not necessarily proof. But let's dive into Marvin Gaye and his family. You know, Marvin is one of plenty of the Motown singers had the church background, Levi Stubb of the Four Tops, David Ruffin of the Temptations, but some of them didn't. Diana Ross of the Supremes, for one, did not have that church background. And Motown famously got black music over as pop in a way that nobody had ever done before. But Marvin was a child of the church. His father was a preacher in a very small sect called the House of God that combines black Pentecostal fervor with Orthodox Judaism's strict rules. They worship on Saturdays. Yeah. The women, they've modified it so the headdresses aren't quite as exotic as they used to be, but the women dress very distinctively. They are very into music. It's a classic Pentecostal church in that way, that the you know, the only command is that you sing joyously. And they when Marvin was growing up, they'd essentially have a full gospel band in there, piano, guitars, bass, joyous singing. But the caveat is they did not believe in using music for secular purposes. And this is going to haunt Marvin through his whole life. Marvin's father, like I said, was a preacher. Initially, he's a fast rising preacher, and this is a very small sect, so you could barely make a living doing this. But nonetheless, he was in good standing until he wasn't. At a certain point, he falls off. But I think one thing I want to emphasize is that Marvin Gaye Sr. was Marvin's original inspiration. He was a brilliant singer and brilliant preacher, and Marvin loved his father's religion. And that's his initial inspiration, that seeing the power of music and love and religion all tied in together is absolutely foundational for Marvin. And so even though Marvin Sr. is a horrific abuser of Marvin, and to a lesser extent, his other siblings, it's easy to overlook why Marvin cared so much what Marvin Sr. thought of him. So your take on the Oedipal relationship here at the center of the story.
Yeah, well, it is sticky. I mean, we could do a whole episode on just their relationship alone. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think Yeah, there is that musical aspect to the House of God, and then there's also a musical aspect sometimes to the way that Black preachers preach, and that seems to have had an impact on Marvin as well. Just the intensity of the message, similar to C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's dad.
And that's an interesting contrast. I'm glad you brought that up, because C.L. Franklin was the big time. Here's somebody who led big marches, who worked with Martin Luther King Jr., who lived in a mansion, who was very wealthy, earned it because he was such a successful preacher for such a big church, one of Detroit's biggest Black churches. Whereas Marvin Gaye Sr. is a pauper by comparison, and eventually quits, stops preaching, altogether. And just lives around the house, frequently wearing women's clothes. And this is something where we kind of have to put an editor note or trigger warning.
Yeah.
The way people saw trans issues in the 40s and 50s and 60s was very different from the way it was seen in the 70s, 80s, the end of Marvin's life, and very different from the way it's seen now. So I think we should have some extra sympathy for Marvin Gaye Sr., who is somebody who felt compelled to wear women's clothing. Apparently he was heterosexual, but and I don't know. He's not alive. He died in 1998. He's not here to tell us if he identified as a woman or, how he would have responded to today's dialogue about trans issues. But that's definitely a complicating factor, and it's something that was very hard on Marvin, because especially pre-sexual revolution, it was something that was seen in a very negative light. And, he added an E to the end of his name to cut down on the jokes, at least, and also to distance himself from his father. And, this is just a complicated stew. And then you've got his mother in there as well. Like when Marvin talks about the church, almost the first thing he says, I love my father's religion, and I loved singing, and I loved those church ladies hugging me to their giant bosoms, and his, there's very much an Oedipal thing with his mother there. She's the protector. She's the one. And there's a third factor, and I'm going to play our first song right quick and explain this. This is Marvin's first hit for Motown, a song that he co-wrote, A Stubborn Kind of Fella. And that was Stubborn Kind of Fella by Marvin Gaye. And I chose that song. I mean, it's his first hit, but it's also, watching some of the documentaries about Marvin, I think it was Mary Wilson who chose that to say, there were three Marvins. There was the beautiful singer, there was the tortured home, the public figure, and then there's the stubborn kind of fella. And somebody else at Motown said that he's the kind of guy who liked to drive the wrong way down one-way streets. he had this dynamic where he had this powerful father figure that he constantly rebelled against, and he would recreate that drama over and over again through the course of his life, whether it's with Berry Gordy or Harvey Fuqua or various managers or the IRS. He constantly rebelled against authority because he was a stubborn kind of fella.
Yeah, man, I think it's worth contrasting again with David Ritz's former subject, Ray Charles. Ray is just so in control. And even though his childhood was in many ways not traditional and sort of looked down upon, somehow Ray, even as he was going blind and his father wasn't really in his life at all, he had a certain amount of stability that Marvin just never displays at any point in his life. And things just always seem out of control for him. And Marvin Sr. really went out of his way to let Marvin Jr. know that he didn't really love him. And you know, I think even we're skipping way ahead, but after Marvin Jr. died, Marvin Sr. was asked, did you like your son? And he says, well, I didn't dislike him. And that just says so much about Marvin's instability. And he just hops from, you know, one parental figure to another throughout his life and never really has any amount of emotional stability there. But I do want to say one thing that really sticks out in this book, which is that there's this archetype, there's this trope of the good Black Christian family. And you know, it's certainly not a myth. There are certainly Black families out there that are plenty stable, but there's this trope in art, and you see this a lot in biographies, where there are these families that all the other Black families look up to, and you say, wow, you know, wish we could be like that family. It's a very aspirational thing. And I think the Cosby Show sort of is the epitome of that. And
Bill Cosby's Fall is the epitome of that underbelly.
Yes,
of that.
Yeah. And the underside is exactly what Cosby's life was like. And you see this trope come up a lot in a lot of Black art. And Tyler Perry has made millions of dollars off of this dichotomy. But it's around because it's real and it does crop up. And I think there's something about keeping up appearances when, you know, inside the house or inside the person, things aren't going nearly as well, that I think follows Marvin's career and the way he approaches his career. He sort of, if he didn't invent the idea of this like R&B lover man, he definitely perfected it. There's like R&B before, there's male R&B singers before Marvin Gaye, and particularly before Let's Get It On, and there are male R&B singers afterwards, and it's just a different thing. And he did that, but at the same time, he resented that.
Yeah, his views on sex are very interesting. He viewed all secular singing as a sin, and I don't think he ever really let that go. And he, you know, starts singing with doo-wop groups as a teen, and he loves the music and he's passionate about it, but he always saw it as not what he should be doing. And also, there's a factor of history there. Black men weren't free to be that sexual before Marvin. I mean, you know, before, and even during Marvin's career in the 60s, he wasn't free to be as sexual as he became in the 70s. That's very much a product of the sexual revolution and Black liberation, because that's the kind of thing so many Black men have been murdered for and are still murdered for to this day. We've got a so screwed up society and culture about the way we sexualize Black men. So it's a very, very much a third rail for performers up until Marvin's point, and Marvin just blew the doors wide open on that. And, you know, I think, you know, so many performers today should thank Marvin for that freedom that he helped them win. But, you know, he loves church music, but he's also listening to, you know, Rudy West with the Five Keys, gospel singer, Clyde McFadder with the Drifters. And
underrated guy.
Yeah, very much underrated. I need to do an episode on him at some point. Little Willie John, who I've done an episode on, who's Detroit's great soul singer of the era, and Ray Charles. Those are the four Black R&B singers that Marvin cited. He also loved Johnny Ray, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and especially Perry Como. And we'll talk about it in a minute. He aspired to that kind of pop throne. He was also a jazz fan, loved Billie Holiday and Miles Davis, but you pointed out there's somebody missing from his list of his big four.
Yeah, I just can't believe that Sam Cooke wasn't a big influence. It's just, I mean, he put an E on the end of his name the same way that Sam Cooke has an E on the end of Cook. I wonder if
it's because Sam Cooke is too close to home, and also because Sam Cooke was the one who got the heat for going secular.
Yes.
And I think Marvin Maye, you know, and as crazy as Marvin was, he might have actually resented Sam for that. He might never have forgiven Sam for going secular. he's not around to ask. But yeah, so just
it could be. But also, I think, and this is just ominous, but as Marvin's career got going, Berry Gordy, when Sam Cooke died, was thinking about creating a movie bio with Marvin starring as Sam Cooke, and Marvin didn't want to do it because he didn't want to play the part of a R&B singer that got shot to death, which is just
Yeah, it is. And you know, several of the documentaries mentioned Marvin had prophetic dreams as a child of being a singer and the whole world listening to him sing. And apparently he also had prophetic visions of being shot to death and basically ensured it would happen by buying his father a gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the Oedipal connections just pile up in this story. I mean, there's so much fate and predestination and doom and, you know, self-fulfilling prophecies all through this. But let's keep it moving. We need to listen to another song. And let's jump ahead a few years to Marvin's famous duets with Tammy Terrell. And this is You're All I Need to Get by Ashford and Simpson. And that was Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell doing You're All I Need to Get By, written and produced by Ashford and Simpson. Brilliant production team, incredibly powerful duet, but let's get Marvin there. So Marvin is doing R&B doo-wop in D.C. He even spends some time in the Air Force. Total disaster, as anyone who knows anything about Marvin Gaye could see coming. And then comes back, forms a group called the Marquise. He's singing second tenor and sometimes baritone harmony. He can do it all. Everybody recognizes he's quite talented, but he initially, at least, is not the lead vocalist. And through sort of a weird sequence of events, ends up meeting Bo Diddley, who produces a record on him. Record flops. But then Bo Diddley ends up introducing him to Harvey Fuqua of the Moonglows, who's a big player at Chess Records, big key artist in the doo-wop era. And Harvey pulls a James Brown trick where he replaces the Moonglows one night, brings Marvin and his crew in to replace him wholesale. Just a classic R&B move.
Yeah, those some of the most influential band leaders just happen to be some of the underhanded is a nice word for it. Yeah. I'm trying to find the nicest words for it, but you know, this is secular music. It's pretty cutthroat, especially at the time. It still is to a certain extent, but back then, you know, Marvin was, just out of his teenage years. He's going to go along with it because he doesn't know any better. But it works out for him. And Fuqua shows him this really innovative thing called blow harmony, where Fuqua does woos instead of do's. And that little change may seem insignificant, but it means so much to Marvin's singing. He's always doing these woos. And when you do that, your chest just spews a really, really powerful sound that makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. It's like he gets a masterclass in harmony singing from Fuqua. And he's going to apply that later on when he sings harmony with himself on what's going on and going forward. And, you know, you listen to some of the tapes on YouTube of Marvin singing harmony for himself, and it's just incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and Harvey, like I said, Fuqua is a big wheel at Chess Records in Chicago. So Marvin ends up singing backup with Etta James on Chuck Berry's Back in the USA. I mean, that's just heavy duty to me, like the idea of Etta James and Marvin Gaye backing up Chuck Berry on that song. And, you know, so he's in the mix. They do some records with the Moon Glows, even a couple with Marvin singing lead. But Fuqua makes a move around this time where one of the Chess brothers actually introduces him to Gwen Gordy, Berry Gordy's sister, who's an entrepreneur in her own right and has a couple record labels. Harvey has signed Marvin Gaye to a lifetime contract at this point. And the two of them end up migrating to Detroit, where Harvey romances and ultimately marries Gwen Gordy. And Marvin, and this is a great quote from the book. Marvin says, "Harvey was the one who showed me that romance could do you a world of good in business." And Marvin ends up hooking up and marrying Anna Gordy, who's 17 years older than he is and is also Berry Gordy's sister, in a very canny alliance. And it's also a love deal. I don't want it to sound like Marvin's prostituting himself, although he sometimes described it in those terms himself, although he also described singing in those terms. He felt like singing to these audiences of aroused women was prostituting himself and caused him all kinds of performance anxiety and worry. But this is just a really savvy move on his part. And it also brings him into a very different family, a family that in some ways lives up to those ideals of the bougie black family that the Gays had aspired to or tried to display. And I'm talking about the Gordys, of course.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. It seems like Pops Gordy was a pretty cool dude. And his children are just these dynamic people that have all kinds of ideas, and because of the ways their parents have operated, they have opportunities that a lot of black families just didn't, to make some of these ambitions come true. And it actually, I believe Anna starts a record label before Berry does. Berry is writing songs for Jackie Wilson and doing really well with that in the late 50s. But Anna's really the one that gets things going, and then Motown kind of absorbs Anna Records. It's a very savvy move by Marvin Gaye. Motown Records really in a lot of ways is kind of like almost literal black royalty in Detroit. And Berry is the king, the benevolent king. And he's got everybody on feudal contracts.
Yeah, that's one thing that fascinates me about Berry Gordy. I mean, you know, I view Berry Gordy as the most successful musician of his era by far. Yeah. You know, because he's a musician, he's a singer, you know, songwriter in his own right. I don't know of any songs he sang on record, but he's a great songwriter, producer in his own right, and has this unique ability to attract other people like him to himself and builds this team. I mean, I don't think anybody to this day has ever matched. There have been some great record labels, but I don't think anybody has ever matched what Motown had together at its peak. And even people, and virtually all of them had falling outs with him, except for maybe Smokey Robinson and his sisters. But even people like the Holland Brothers, who had decades-long legal wars with Berry Gordy, always acknowledged that he was a loving person and that there was a loving family environment. He might be stealing you blind for your publishing rights, but somehow he's paying people. He's not, you know, one of these guys. I'm blanking on the name of the guy from Roulette Records that was such a criminal. I mean, Berry Gordy shouldn't be compared to that kind of, you know, straight up grifter, but he did end up getting richer than everybody else by an order of magnitude. And, you know, but it's this loving family and it's very competitive, and he's pulling people around him like Smokey Robinson, who's pretty unique at Motown because he's not only a singer, but he's also a songwriter and producer. And most of the time, the lines are very strict. You know, Eddie Holland sang, but then he quit singing and became part of Holland Dozier Holland. And, you know, people like Mickey Stevenson and Clarence Fall and others, they couldn't record their own stuff. They were producers, but
Ashford
they had a
Simpson.
Yeah, Ashford and Simpson, you know, and obviously they go on to a very successful singing career on their own after they leave Motown. But Marvin, partly I assume because he's got Anna, and also because he is the stubborn kind of fellow, and just, to me, managing Marvin Gaye would be one of the worst nightmares, you know.
and the greatest dream at the same time. I think what you're saying about Berry Gordy is mirrored in Marvin Gaye. People were constantly exasperated with Marvin Gaye, but they always loved him and admired him too. Berry was constantly exasperated with Marvin Gaye, but he loved him and was in awe of his musical brilliance. Marvin could never quite wrap his head around just how much Berry appreciated him in that way. But he was loved. I think it's worth mentioning that, again, to bring things back to Ray Charles, Marvin really felt, and I think everybody at Motown really felt, like Ray Charles had sold out, and he started to use, and I definitely see the point. Ray had used these syrupy kind of lazy strings and these heavenly choirs. He kind of put that in the background of music where he's still singing amazingly, and rode that into the mainstream and to number one many times. Marvin and other people at Motown really felt like he had sold out in that way, and that, you know, he was very clearly playing to white audiences and didn't care about black audiences anymore. And Berry Gordy was also displeased with the way that Jackie Wilson was being produced, and he's got all these syrupy strings going on, and it just didn't feel right. I think there's something to that attitude, and Motown by no means was ignoring the white market, but the way they went about it was very black. I think that's important.
Absolutely. And let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll hear, in light of what you just said, kind of a surprising what Marvin's first attack on the pop market was. And so everything you said is true, but nonetheless, Marvin Gaye's initial angle was to be somebody who was aiming himself at that white pop market. His first Motown album is ballads and standards. And it wasn't just Marvin that did that. I mean, the Supremes recorded whole albums, but I think it was Rodgers and Hammerstein. they played the Copacabana. Marvin played the Copacabana. You know, they were very much watching what Ray Charles had done. And like we discussed when we talked about Ray Charles, that worked brilliantly for him, but I think the doors were kind of closing on that option by the time the Motown people came along, and they didn't realize the real way for success with the white audience is going to be like what's going on and following the Beatles and other rock artists who have these rock era serious work rather than a pop era serious work. But Marvin tries this pop stuff. It doesn't work. And so then he gets to break the rules at Motown and co-write a song, comes out with Stubborn Kind of Fellow, works with Mickey Stevenson and Berry Gordy on that. And you know, for somebody who was resistant and didn't want to, he didn't go to the Motown Charm School. He definitely didn't go to the choreography school very much. And you know, felt like I don't have to do that stuff. But he was also very competitive and wanted to be successful. And he was just so talented and also so churchy. I think it was very easy for him to do R&B because it was in his bones. That kind of, to me, you know, hard R&B comes out of gospel, and Marvin had it, and it was easy for him. And he struggled with the standards. He wouldn't master that kind of stuff until very late in his career. And when he did master, you know, the Sinatra style.
It was remarkable.
But his early attempts at it, he just doesn't bring enough Marvin Gaye into it. It's beautifully sung. The songs are well selected and well arranged, but he's not bringing the Marvin Gaye. And that's what he does bring to the R&B stuff that he does. And quickly goes on a run. And you know, one thing I found fascinating about this is Marvin's unique to my knowledge in that he had hits with Mickey Stevenson, Clarence Paul, who's Stevie Wonder's main guy, Holland Dozier Holland, Norman Whitfield, Smokey Robinson, and Ashford and Simpson. I can't think of another Motown artist that worked successfully with that many different producers. Usually, if you were trying different producers, it was because, you know, like the no-hit Supremes couldn't get a hit with Berry Gordy, couldn't get a hit with Smokey Robinson. Go with Holland Dozier Holland and ride that out until, you know, they can't anymore because of legal disputes. Marvin's just flitting around working with producer after producer. It's really amazing. And it might make him the definitive Motown artist.
In many ways, yeah. You can go through Marvin's discography in the 60s and really get a good sense of the Motown sound, at least the solo Motown sound. And there's you know, the sound that they had for groups was a little different. But even then, eventually he starts producing the originals, and then he starts doing multi-tracking, and he's kind of you could call him the Rosetta Stone of Motown. That's accurate, I think.
And so he has these solo hits, but at the same time, very early on, he starts doing duets, first with Mary Wells, who's the initial queen of Motown before the rise of the Supremes. And then, you know, she has some legal disputes with Berry Gordy. So Kim Weston steps up and she and Marvin have hits together. But it's really when Tammy Terrell, who had been a backup singer for James Brown and a lover of James Brown and a victim of James Brown, partners with Marvin Gaye, that it really takes off. And they have a series of duets, not all of which are produced by Ashford and Simpson, but I think that's really the team where Ashford and Simpson first make their mark at Motown. You know, they were kind of newcomers who came in after Holland Dozier Holland left. And Tammy and Marvin have this incredible musical love affair. And by all accounts, it's strictly a musical love affair. She was seeing David Ruffin of the Temptations at that time, another handful. Not somebody I would want my love his singing, not somebody I would want my daughter involved with it by any means. Yeah. And, you know, and James Brown apparently had really hurt Tammy. And then she collapses in Marvin's arms on stage in 1967, lingers for, I want to say, another 18 months and passes. And this really, really impacts Marvin. And this had also impacted his marriage because Anna was jealous of all three of his duet singers, even if that was unfounded. But he was having affairs with groupies and Anna was having affairs. There's a story about Marvin chasing him in a motel, chasing randomly going to a motel and randomly walking up to a door and knocking on it and catching Anna with another man. I don't know that that's true. It's impossible to check that, but that was Marvin's version of events. And
yeah, he just felt the room in his soul. I don't know, man. But
yeah.
Lots of weird things have happened, that's for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are accounts of Anna hitting Marvin with the heel of her shoe at their wedding reception. You know, so they had a violent relationship, and apparently Anna was giving as good as she got. Although you got to clarify, men bigger and stronger and tend to be more at fault in these domestic violence situations. But it also takes two to tango, and Anna had a lot of resources on her own, very powerful person.
And was 17 years older than than Marvin.
Yeah, and is also sexually experienced and sexually open-minded in a way that Marvin was not and was not ever comfortable with. And so, you know, just that relationship brought Marvin a lot of good things and great things, and also left some scars and twisted Marvin. And also around this time, he cuts a song with Norman Whitfield, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And he's the second person at Motown to cut it. Smokey Robinson had cut it earlier. It doesn't come out on either of them. Rejected by the quality commission, the committee at both points. But then it gets to number one with Gladys Knight and the Pips doing what I would consider a pretty standard 1967 Motown version. Then Norman Whitfield comes back at Berry Gordy a year later and says, let's release that Marvin version because it sounds like 1968. And it's an epic hit. It's the biggest hit in Motown history. And it basically allows Marvin to coast on that for the next couple of years. But to me, it's just fascinating that Marvin and Norman Whitfield are making a track that is so 68 in the middle of – in early 67. I mean, Bob Dylan and the band are about the only people that are on that 68 vibe in 67 to the same extent as Whitfield and Gaye. And it is just – it's been overplayed. It's been played into the ground. But my God, it is a seminal track.
Yeah, I think that's – I think you're making an interesting – it's an interesting thought there because 67 is, you know, this time of great hope and energy, and 68 is you're headed into despair and wondering where did it all go wrong. And those two different, I really, really like the Gladys Knight and the Pips version.
It's great.
It is great. It's a lot of fun. That's the one you want to play on the dance floor if you're a DJ. you do not want to play the Marvin Gaye version, or maybe you would, but you don't want to pay too much attention to the mood of that track. It is really a masterpiece, Marvin's version. And you know, some credit has to go to Norman Whitfield for being a production genius. Sometimes I think he overcooked it a little bit with some of the Temptations stuff, Ball of Confusion, things like that.
Into this ornate psychedelic sound. And this is one of the things where I think fate kind of stepped in because of Marvin's grief at Tammy Terrell's passing and his own stubbornness and stage fright. He takes and then the massive success of I Heard It Through the Grapevine, he finally makes real money as a performer from this. And it allows him to kind of take a breather for a couple of years. And it's exactly through those kind of awkward psychedelic years where people like Sly Stone and the Temptations are reformulating soul and innovating funk. And Marvin gets to kind of step back and not be on the scene during that period. And he says it, you know, in the autobiography, and maybe this is hindsight on his part, but maybe he was conscious of it at the time. He's recharging his batteries through that whole period. And I think it's also very important to – the thing about Marvin Gaye is he's an artist who's living in a fantasy world who acknowledges that he creates these interpersonal dramas as a way of fueling his muse, as a way of being inspired and being in these heightened emotional states to create his art. He said artists must suffer for their art, for the public, you know, for their audience. And he certainly did that to himself and to everyone around him. But then he comes through with What's Going On. And this is one area where the book is really frustrating because it doesn't talk much about the recording of What's Going On. And there's not a 33 and a third book on that album yet, which seems crazy to me. But it doesn't go into the story of the making of What's Going On. We know James Jamerson was on it. It was still in Detroit. The sessions are very different. And obviously it's this widely acknowledged masterpiece.
Yeah, that is, well, I think there we have to remember that Divided Soul came out in what, 85, I think? 86, something like that, 85. And I think that Ritz definitely talks about the impact. He talks about the artistic success of what's going on. But yeah, it is missing the actual making of it. I think you're right. And I think since then, since Marvin died, that recording time has really gone into legend, really. And so, you know, there are lots of stories that we've heard since then about that recording that isn't really here in Divided Soul. And a lot of that really comes from the Funk Brothers and the belated appreciation of the Motown house band.
Absolutely.
Because it's really, as much as it is a Marvin Gaye masterpiece, it's also a masterpiece of the Funk Brothers. In fact, to be somewhat controversial about it, it may even be song for song more of a victory for them than for Marvin.
Controversial. Let's hear a song. This is I'll let you hang on.
Great songs, four classic songs, four of the best songs you'll ever hear, but there are more than four songs on the album.
Yes, yes. Let's hear What's Happening, Brother.
Boys, hell, when will it end? When will people start getting together again? Are things really getting better, like the newspapers say? What else is new, my friend?
And that's What's Happening, Brother, a song Marvin wrote, inspired by his brother Frankie telling him about his experiences in Vietnam. And apparently Marvin and his brother would talk this over and just cry in the bedroom together at the horror of what was going on in Vietnam. And to me, you know, that's the greatness of Marvin Gaye, is this, you know, he described himself as a sponge and he took in all this pain and he was so aware, not just of his own personal issues, but what was going on in the world. And he makes this statement, you know, and this is an album Berry Gordy did not want to release. He did not want to risk Marvin Gaye's superstardom by doing something controversial. He had always kept Motown away from controversy. But Marvin pushes it through, and it's immediately a success, and it's immediately acknowledged as a masterpiece. And like you said, yeah, I remember when I bought this album in high school after hearing so much about it. And obviously, you know, like you say, that there's just that run of great songs, especially at the start. There might be a little filler in there, but it's also kind of a suite of songs. And so
it fits
together, and it might be that the whole is better than the sum of its parts. I mean, the critical stuff isn't really what we do on the show, but the net effect is he made this album that's an acknowledged masterpiece. It's also the first record to credit Motown musicians. And it's also one of the first records that took Black artists into the album era. Like, Black artists have been so far ahead musically up until the album era for various reasons. And, you know, it wasn't Otis Redding. It wasn't James Brown. Arguably, it was Sly Stone. Sly Stone has a case for having made great albums all the way through, but he never made anything that was such an obvious masterpiece. And Jimi Hendrix is in a different category because he was essentially an English rocker in the marketplace.
I think the person that might be missing there is Curtis Mayfield. Curtis had been working and doing socially conscious stuff for a long time in R&B, and of course in jazz. And jazz, they've been working on that for a long time. Like We Insist, the Max Roach and Abby Lincoln thing, and of course.
And Mayfield's work with The Impressions. Yeah, I should have thought of those because I highly recommend those last three, four albums. Curtis Mayfield is still on with The Impressions. Just incredible stuff. But none of it had the impact of Marvin Gaye doing it.
You're right. This was the representation of the turning point.
Yeah, absolutely. And Marvin, you know, being Marvin, he capitalizes on the success, resists touring. You know, he's always been somebody who was prone to cancel shows at the last minute and very difficult to deal with. And this is another thing that's left out of the book, and partly because it might not have been known at the time when Ritz wrote the book, but Marvin did a whole follow-up album to What's Going On called You're the Man. And when that You're the Man single, it didn't flop, but it wasn't as big a hit as the stuff off What's Going On. You know, it was kind of his response to Watergate. They just pulled the whole album. And it's a great album. You know, I haven't had the title, it only came out last year. But for old time music nerds, man, you know, that was a big day, a big day in my world.
Yeah. I need to go back to that one. When I heard it, I really liked it a lot. I think it's interesting when these long lost recordings come out, because they have this feeling of oldness to them, even though they're completely new. So I'm going to have to internalize that over time, the same way that people have been internalizing What's Going On for, you know, the last 50 years.
Yep.
Almost.
Yes. And yeah, so we're not through digesting You're the Man, but it's definitely significant work, and I'm really happy it's out there. And it's just interesting to think about an artist at this level. It's a lot like Prince thinking, you know, I can't do Manic Monday. That doesn't fit my persona. I've got to put that for somebody else, you know, or that song Sinead O'Connor did. You know, somebody who's that talented and in and aware of the marketplace that he knows, you know, well, this isn't the right move for me. You know, so he takes some time off, and then he meets a 16-year-old girl. Jan Hunt, I think, was her last maiden name. And she's the daughter of Slim Gaillard, who is a 40s R&B jazz singer in L.A. that I talked with R.J. Smith about. So it's just fascinating, all these characters interweaving and connecting. Her mother was a white woman, so she's very much, you know, a light-skinned, beautiful woman. She's 16 when he meets her. Obviously, these days, that kind of thing is frowned upon, but it's 17 years younger than he was, just as he was 17 years younger than his first wife. And unfortunately for Jan and Marvin, cocaine has come in a big way. Marvin started smoking pot back when he was on the road with the Moonglows in the 50s, and that was one thing. But cocaine comes in this period, and it's just a blizzard. All through the early 70s, they've got plenty of money. The party scene is big. And when the freebasing hits in the late 70s is when it really becomes disastrous for Marvin. But Jan and Marvin's whole relationship is dominated by cocaine and this incredible sexual passion that he chronicles in his next album, Let's Get It On, which is another absolute triumph.
That situation with Jan in 2021, Marvin, you ain't getting away with that one, man.
No.
Nor should he. Let's be honest. Nor should he. But it was normalized, and in fact, her mother introduced them. That's one of those, I don't know. You read her book.
And it's intense. And it's, you know, one of these things where she's now a very much a grown woman and is thankful for her time with Marvin. So, you know, it's not my place to judge. And 17 was the age of consent at the time. So, you know, I think it's definitely something that should be open for criticism. And he did become abusive, especially towards the end. But they very much loved each other. They were very much partners. And their on and off relationship dominates the rest of his life. And, you know, after let's go ahead and hear our last song. Let's go with Love Party. This is from his final album, Midnight Love, and this is Love Party by Marvin Gaye. And that was Love Party from his final album, which was his only album on CBS. It's all the only time he left Motown. He left Motown at the end of his career.
Oh, that's Love Party is actually his from his last album with Motown.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. In Our Lifetime. My bad. My bad.
Yeah.
And this is the album that caused him to leave Motown because he was, you know, taking so long to do that album. And we got to catch up a little bit to get to In Our Lifetime. First, he does I Want You, which is an album that was written and produced by Leon Ware with help from T-Bone Ross, Diana Ross's brother. And they essentially, that whole album was coming together, and Berry Gordy said, Marvin, you need to get with Leon. He's got something for you. And Marvin loved it. And that's an album that didn't get the immediate critical plaudits, although it was very successful commercially, but now is recognized as absolutely a hallmark, you know, of the Quiet Storm era, a huge inspiration on the neo-soul movement. So yet another masterpiece for Marvin. He finally gets out there, does some touring. He does a live album that's massively successful because it's got to Give It Up on it, which is his. Yeah. It's a brilliant song. It's the Wallflower dance hit. It's a guy admitting, I can't dance.
Just Marvin being candid.
His whole thing. And it's a massive success, goes double platinum. But again, this is a guy who would not pay his taxes, even though he had accountants and managers who were telling him, Marvin, pay your taxes. You know, he's got a studio in L.A. that he's living in and recording albums. He's finally divorces Anna Gordy, and has blown his money and had so much of his assets seized while he's on tour because of the IRS situation that he does a whole album as alimony. Here, my dear. And it's rejected by the public on initial release. I mean, he initially said, I'm going to make the worst album ever, and you know, she's going to get all the money from it. But he couldn't help himself, and he made another classic. I mean, it's much more difficult than What's Going On or Midnight Love, but it's well worth the study, and it's just another – it's exhibitionism. I mean, it is, no holds barred, but musically it's fascinating. And then he's working on In Our Lifetime, which was originally going to be his disco album. And I'm blanking on what the title of that was going to be, but it was taking him so long to get together and get that out. Motown ultimately stole the tapes from one of his guitar players and puts it out in a way Marvin didn't approve of. Certain songs were unfinished. They took the question mark off of the title. It was supposed to be In Our Lifetime question mark. Meaning, you know, is nuclear war going to happen? Another fascinating album. And that's it for him and Motown. You know, between the divorce from Barry's sister and this album going out without his permission, you know, he can't deal with it. He jumps ship. Harvey Fuqua comes back into his life. He has this massive downward spiral. And forgive me for rushing, but we're just running out of time. But
sure.
He spends time in Hawaii living in a bread truck, has his young son with him at some points, goes to England. Yeah. Promoter Jeffrey Kruger gets him to England, where he does a pretty successful tour and then manages to stand up Princess Margaret. I mean, if you think Meghan Markle's having a hard time, that was just not something you did as a black performer in the 70s. Burns all his bridges, gets into a very, very dark place in London. Women around him all the time. He's freebasing cocaine. This Belgian promoter, Freddie Cousart, kind of comes to his rescue, takes him to a small town on the North Sea, and just lets him live and heal and recover and get clean. That's when he records Sexual Healing, cuts this deal with CBS, and his old mentor, Harvey Fuqua, comes back into the picture. And Marvin's the credited producer on Midnight Love, but Harvey was very involved in that production. And all is well. He makes an album. He wants to do a commercial album. He's competitive. He wants to get back on the charts. It succeeds. And then he has to go back to the States. His mother's very ill. He has lots of legal issues to deal with there. He wants to make the money from touring. Goes back to the States. Goes on tour. The tour is, at some performances, very successful. Later performances on the tour, disastrous, particularly a gig at the Radio City Music Hall, and then moves back in with his mother and father. He's moved them from D.C. to L.A., bought him a big mansion, And, you know, on that last tour, Marvin had a room. He had a Coke dealer on one side of him, and he had his preacher on the other side. He goes home, and his mother is in the middle with Marvin on one side and Marvin Gaye Sr. on the other side. Marvin buys his father a gun. And groupies are still coming to the house. People are, you know, all kinds of hangers-on are coming and going. And I can understand from Marvin Sr.'s perspective, I wouldn't want to have that in my house either, you know. And they get into it. Marvin Sr.'s been yelling at Marvin's mother. Marvin beats him up, which is something he'd always wanted to do, had never done apparently, and apparently beat him viciously.
Yeah, and got to him.
Yeah, and Marvin Sr. took that gun that Marvin had bought him and killed him with it. And, you know, it's just...
It's really a tragedy. And, I mean, one thing that should be said about Marvin Gaye is that this guy had it really rough in his childhood, and his relationship with his dad never really got much better. It seemed like his dad had some really, really deep issues that were not addressed the way that they could have been. And his son, you know, absolutely suffered for it. It should be said that that for somebody who had that kind of life, Marvin actually did pretty good. It's said that, you know, he was really lazy and took forever to make albums and stuff. But, you know, comparatively, he did really well.
Yeah, he put together really, I mean, a body of work that will stand with anybody's, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, anybody.
Absolutely. That run from What's Going On, and, you know, I only put it down because you know, it's seen as number one, but What's Going On is great. And that run from What's Going On to Here, My Dear is amazing. Trouble Man, Let's Get It On, I Want You. Those are just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful albums. And you know, even as all this turmoil is going on, In My Lifetime is still really good. And Midnight Love is just fantastic. And you would have thought that he had the comeback that he needed for forever. But this is the case of cocaine just like... Just making things a lot worse.
Absolutely.
And, there were times when he probably should have died before he did.
Yeah, and apparently at the end he was just a broken man. And I've yeah. lost people, and I've seen that. You know, I've known people who had something happen to them so shattering that they could never come back from it. And apparently he was in that state, and you know, manipulated these circumstances. And I also want to mention, you know, first ballot Hall of Famer from the 70s album, but also a first ballot Hall of Famer. If he had died after Heard It Through the Grapevine, he still got one of the great bodies of work of any artist of that era. You know,
absolutely.
It was singles rather than albums. So just the amount of accomplishment in his life is incredible. It's thank you, Marvin. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's just a blessing to everybody with ears that's alive today and able to hear it. And prayers for the whole family, man. I mean, even Marvin Sr., that guy really, I cannot imagine having to live with that. And he lived with that for like till 1998. Now, I don't know if he was capable of grasping the magnitude of what he had done. But I would not want that on my karma.
Yeah, the grace is that I may have this wrong, but I'm not sure if something happened with Marvin's mom. I think she paid his bail or something like that. And somehow he didn't end up ever serving any time in prison. And Well, you know.
Yeah. He got probation.
To feel about that, but
yeah, he got off, and you know, it is what it is. But he was divorced from his wife, so she was free of him. Although, as far as I know, she was never that abusive. But anyway, it's time to wrap this. Nathan Wilcox and Brooks Long. We've been discussing Divided Soul, The Life of Marvin Gaye by David Ritz. Also, After the Dance, My Life with Marvin Gaye by Jan Gay. And when you come back, we're going out to the big one, Aretha Franklin. Might need 2 hours for that one.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Greg Beats to discuss the Austin music scene of the 1990s. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.